What the If is brought to you by listeners like you, thanks to our Patreon members, patreon.com/whattheif. Go there now and find out how you can become a member and get all kinds of cool rewards. And thank you for supporting our mission for science education and science fun. Welcome. I blew out my own ears. To what? The If. Super duper eclipse edition. That's just a tease of our upcoming If. Stay tuned, coming right to you, our thought experiment of the week. But first, we have with us, as always, our co-pilots. I almost said Dr. Gabby Panicia, but not doctor. Is there a sort of just before, almost all but doctor? How about that?
Yeah, ABD.
That's
the technical term, but it's a weird title, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You only have it for about the month before you defend. It's very transient.
Right. Exactly. Gabby Panicia from Rockefeller University, who is very close to achieving illustrious PhD status. And still manages to get on our show, to come to get up and do our show on a Friday morning, which we appreciate immensely.
I still think it's so important for me because I need to talk to people while I'm writing my thesis, so I remember like what it's like to be a human being again. Because oh boy, sometimes it's a little rough.
Yeah,
I'll bet. Also with us, someone who has lived through that experience. Is that, that's right?
Yeah, like 50% lived through, yeah.
50% lived through.
You didn't fully make it out.
Exactly. Part of me is still sitting in the library, yeah.
Dr. Matt Stanley, and you graduated from, where was that, your PhD?
Oh, someplace in Boston.
Ah, someplace in Boston.
Easy to forget.
Easy to forget. And how are you, sir?
I'm just sitting here in the dark. I don't know if anybody has any suggestions for how to make sense of that. But.
Oh, very good. Very good. That is an allusion to either NYU's inability to pay their electric bills, which I doubt seriously, considering the tuition, which I paid for a bit when I was there. But or it's an allusion to our thought experiment that's coming up, which... each week is torn from the hands of our listeners, mm-hmm. or willingly given, perhaps willingly given over by from our listeners, or from headlines in the news, or from the heavens above. So we'll get to that in a moment. Just real quick, I wanted to hit the old mailbag. Oh boy, we have. Incoming mail from our old friend Lars in Sweden. Lars is wonderfully prolific and communicative with us. And Lars wrote in, all of Lars's emails are full of heart and warmth and stories and all kinds of things, epic tales. But I'm just going to read a little of them. I'm just sharing the highlights. And this week, Lars writes, "Hello, fellow Thinquanauts," which is what he calls him. I like that, Thinquanauts. And he mentions that, so for the last week, it has been Easter here in Sweden. Loads of egg eating. It was Easter here also. How about that? And he says it would be interesting to make a What the If with, an Easter-influenced What the If. What about... what the if neither the chicken nor the egg came first? That's pretty good. He also has a suggestion. Sometimes I save these for shows. This one, you know, I just want to mention it because I thought it was quite colorful, and it goes into the our vault for future shows. He asks, "What the if we didn't develop nostrils? If we only had one respiratory hole?" And we would also sneeze through it. What would it sound like to talk to one another? I'm going to let our listeners ponder that for a little while. I think that's a good one. We're going to mull that over. We have a we convene a committee to investigate these. What do they call it? What would a scientific organization do? We have to convene a study group. to investigate this. So the What the If team will be investigating this scenario. Gabby, they may have to talk to you about doing some sort of genetic experiments here to figure out simulations, purely simulations, about what would happen there. And then Lars adds, with those, I have used 15 out of 90 ifs. He has many more to come.
Wow. All right.
And he ends with a, he always ends with a little quote from, it's a Swedish myth, I suppose. Havamal. Are you familiar with that, Matt?
Havamal. Oh, I'm aware of its existence, but I've not read it.
So the 41st verse says, as usual, he says, as usual, words of wisdom from Havamal. With weapons and clothes, friends should please each other. That is always clearest on oneself. Those who give in return and give again are mutual friends the longest, if that continues to go well.
I like that. All right.
I like that. I don't know if it's meant to be a cliffhanger. And Lars signs, as always, Space Viking. Thank you, Space Viking. And that concludes the mailbag portion of the episode. And we thank the What the If players for taking us down that road. So this week's If, ripped from the heavens. Matt, perhaps you can tell us, remind people who don't know what's happening in a few days and how this will influence our if our thought experiment this week.
In a few days, my students have their papers due. So presumably the chat bots are overloaded as they're putting in prompts. But that's probably not what you're asking about. In a few days, it seems that the natural order of the universe will be upended, and the greatest of celestial bodies, our own sun, will be blotted from the sky. But it's actually not a disruption of the natural order, right? It's just an unusual confluence of events. But what we do here is we actually do upend the natural order and change up reality a little bit. Hopefully with the process, with the goal of learning something along the way, but sometimes just to destroy the universe.
Yes, yes. And I would say that since the average, I was going to say the average human, but I won't drag Sweden into that or Australia or any of our other devoted fans. I'll just say Americans, anything, a cycle that lasts longer than a day, we can't.
Totally unimaginable.
We can't imagine that. And so if something odd happens, you know, what happens every year and a half or something like that? What? No. That's insane. So Gabby comes to us with this wonderful idea. So Gabby, why don't you just set the context before we then state the incantation and begin the thought experiment?
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
Yeah, so I had a couple thoughts in mind, but it was mostly that, you know, for one, if you don't know that what an eclipse is, that it's just sort of a confluence of events, it's probably going to scare the crap out of you. The sun goes dark and everything, you know, gets quiet. It's a weird event. And understanding what was happening probably represents, you know, a very scientifically important thing for humanity to start looking at and understanding the heavens. So my thought process here was about, you know, can we kind of retrace the steps of probably multiple societies individually, let's be honest, in figuring out why the hell the sun goes dark sometimes.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, Matt, we're going to announce with great fanfare, we're going to sound the klaxon, which happens to sound like a game show, TV game show theme, prepare the experiment. But why do people need to be careful, and how should they prepare themselves for this?
Well, we're likely to suddenly not have much sunlight. So if you're like walking along the edge of a cliff, you might want to step back from the edge a little bit until the light comes back. Or if you're doing other similarly light-dependent things like holography or open-heart surgery, just take a pause.
Take a pause as we ask, what the if? We return to caveman times. And we don't know what an eclipse is. We don't know what's going on. We don't know why it's happening. And we decide, let's figure it out. I like it. So we're not, you know, we're not sort of just casual cavemen sitting around, you know, noticing things in the sky and going, eh, that was weird. And then getting back to our eating our giant dinosaur mutton, you know, like they win the Flintstones or something. We decide we're going to find things out. So, yeah, it is interesting. Gabby, when you mentioned that this is something that would have happened in multiple cultures, it's like, yeah, like every single, obviously every single culture in the world has to go through this. If an eclipse happens overhead, which eventually does pretty much
Yeah, it's everywhere on the planet. Everybody's going to encounter it at some point. Yeah.
But so, not all simultaneously, importantly.
No, that would have been pretty cool, though. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be cool. Describe for us, let's say we are a particular tribe in, and we say caveman times. What era might we be talking about?
Oh, yeah, caveman is a totally non-specific term, right? So we probably mean something like the Paleolithic period. So somewhere between 50,000 years ago back to, I don't know, 500,000 or so. Ooh. So basically, biologically modern humans, ability to build tools, probably a relatively complex society. Right. So we've got our stone hammers and our axes, and we probably can make clothes, and we probably live in somewhat organized groups. Making cave paintings, probably not writing.
Yeah. It's interesting. I just remembered, because everything I learned from movies. And I just remembered the movie 2001, famously, where there are early humans in the opening chapter. And they eventually see a strange alien object, which is not part of our thought experiment this time. But above the monolith, the strange object, the rectangle that they see, there is like an eclipse happening.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I hadn't really thought about that. But an eclipse might have been one of those things that got people thinking. We'll just say that, certainly. So we have someone in our party has a particular scientific itch or some sort of itch. How might this particular, I don't know, Dr. Zayas, they have responded?
Well, so I think probably the first thing we need to tag here is that we're probably talking about a total solar eclipse. So partial eclipses, and where part of the sun is obscured, but not all of it. Annular eclipses, where again, part of the center part of the sun is obscured, but not the entire thing. Those are weird because the brightness of the sun does decrease sometimes dramatically. But for instance, here in New York City, Monday's eclipse is going to be 90% total, which sounds like a lot, but it turns out that last 10% of the sun is still super bright. So, even for a 90% eclipse, it just gets a little dim for a little while. Kind of like a cloudy day. It's not, if you don't know it's a thing to be looking for, you might not even notice it. And that's different than a total solar eclipse, where the moon exactly obscures the disk of the sun. So it becomes completely dark and the corona is visible. And that is, it happens all of a sudden. There's no the transition takes a fraction of a second. And then all of a sudden it is completely dark where you are. But a few miles away, there is still sunlight. So all of a sudden it becomes a sunrise, sunset kind of effect on the horizon, but it's totally night where you are. You might be able to see stars all of a sudden. There's these bizarre structures in the sky that nowadays we call the corona, these long glowing tendrils that look kind of vaguely organic. That you can't see in any other circumstances. So they appear all of a sudden. You know, animals start acting weird, it's cold. And then after a few minutes, everything goes back to normal. Okay. So that's what we're talking about, I think, here, right? You can't not notice a total eclipse when you're in it, right?
And I experienced my first total eclipse that had a clear sky, so I could actually see the moon and the sun going through their phases. A few years ago. And the weirdest thing to me was that it was silent. Like, I think I was just so used to seeing, there'd be dramatic music or some kind of sound, you know? And as much as I absolutely know that that's just, a movie convention or whatever, it just subconsciously seemed really weird. Also because everyone I was with became silent, you know, as they were just hushed tones.
Rare that we see anything happen atmospherically without noise, right? This is a single thing happening that just immediately makes everything dark. If things go dark, you know, it's usually because clouds came in, which is like slower, or there's thunder and lightning. This is just sort of a thing that happens in a way that I feel like, you know, if the sky went red because a bomb went off, you expect noise or something like that. Like, it's right. Such a big thing to happen, and it is so far away. So it's completely silent.
Or even if it was a plane passing in front of something, you know.
Yeah, you'd hear it.
You'd hear it, yeah. And I must say, the other thing is, Matt, you mentioned the corona. That also was just so strange because of the corona. And everything seems to move at a speed. You can observe that motion is happening. You know, we're used to, again, we think of things on just the gigantic scale of things. You don't really see the motion, you know. This you could just totally see, and the corona is moving around, as you said, almost organically. It's very strange. So my first thought is that the cave people, as we will call them scientifically, would already have a story or an idea about the sun and the moon, right? So if they were creatures or gods or whatever the eclipse, their first explanation for the eclipse is going to be, oh, well, that creature did that to that creature.
Let's hear. Yeah, so if you think of the celestial bodies as being animate in that sense, right? That the sun is a living thing and the moon is a living thing. And that's not an unreasonable position to take, because the first thing you know about the sun is that it's bright. The second thing you know about the sun is that it moves across the sky every day. Right? And it's not unreasonable to associate movement with life, right? That's perfectly straightforward thing. That's actually, you know, that's where the word animal comes from, right? The thing that moves. So that's not unreasonable. And the moon also moves, but in a different pattern, a slightly more complicated pattern than the sun, especially because it changes shape. And that's also a thing you might associate with living things too. So I think we're not unreasonable for thinking that the sun and the moon are living creatures that do stuff up in the sky every day and every night.
Yeah. And the difference between our if scenario right now and other ways you may have thought about this scenarios is that we have a member of our party, at least one member of our party, maybe two, who want to investigate that. Is that different? Like, when I think of we can hear all kinds of myths about this is how this culture saw the sun and the moon, right? Many different cultures and many different stories about the sun and the moon. Don't generally hear stories of them, of someone trying to test the truth of that. Of course, they might have understood that there was no way for them to test it, but what are we going to do? We have a young scientist in the party, a budding scientist.
Know. Yeah, Gabby, I'm imagining that's you. What's your first take on this weirdo situation?
So my first thought is that a lot of times the first attempt to understand these things was still through the lens of myth. And mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. you need mm-hmm. a lot of cumulative observation in a way that has to be sustained longer than one hunting party. So I think we've talked about this a lot on the show about like cumulative knowledge and like how humanity's knowledge is fundamentally built on itself, which is how we've reached where we have. You can't in one generation go from caveman to spaceship because so much of our knowledge hinges on knowledge being held dispersed. Some people knowing some parts of a whole thing rather than all of us needing to know everything. I think if you are a caveman starting from zero, just looking at the sun and the moon, you are probably going to be first, you know, the things that you're figuring out are not these once in 50 year eclipses, what you're probably figuring out is, like Matt said, movements, the way that the duration of days and nights changes. So you probably figure out equinoxes. And because, like I said, you know, the scientific method is a thing that had to be developed over time. You know, you probably are still cloaking those things in the lens of whatever your hunting party's spiritual beliefs are. There are plenty of human myths and legends, et cetera, that revolve around the various equinoxes and the changing of the seasons, because that's something that we've picked up even from very, very early on in our sort of caveman days. So I think you actually do a lot of science still cloaked in belief system until you maybe reach a certain point. So I think for Throg, et cetera, who are here, we're still maybe thinking of the sun and moon in terms of more, you know, deity or animist versus mm-hmm. these are two things floating in space.
Yeah, so this record keeping is actually a super important aspect of the story, because even realizing that eclipses have anything to do with the moon requires some record keeping and planning and continuous knowledge, because solar eclipses happen during the new moon when you can't see the moon, so. Even, and of course, during the day, you can't see the moon at all. So if you see the sun starting to get dark and you want to say that has something to do with the presence of the moon, you need to know that the moon is there, even though it's invisible.
I didn't think about that. Yeah, so it that really means, does come out of nowhere.
Yeah, so that means you need to be able to, you need to have good enough records, written or oral or whatever, that you know where the moon is in the sky at any given time. And I should say, our cave folks probably did know. That is, they did seem to observe the phases of the moon pretty regularly. And what is sometimes described as the very first written object or sort of inscribed object is a bone with 28 markings on it that look an awful lot like the tracking of the phases of the moon. And there's a funny / awful story told by a woman anthropologist when she was in her in a class in graduate school in the 1960s. And her professor was describing this artifact. And the professor said, we can't think of any reason why anyone would want to track a 28-day cycle. and she had this moment of insight, and she's like, wow, we've let men be in charge of anthropology way too long. It's a great story.
That is a great story. Yeah, and of course, our we've since discovered. I guess maybe it was in the 60s that I remembered the idea that Stonehenge might be an astronomical, might be a, you know, Stonehenge might be designed around astronomical events was controversial. Right.
Well, yeah, and there's a sense in which it still is today. So,
oh, wow.
If you once you get a bunch of astronomical records written down, so like things like lunar cycles, Gabby was talking about the equinoxes. There's a bunch of patterns that happen with the motions of the sun and the moon that you might be interested in writing down. But you need to, you know, obviously for an equinox, you need to keep good records for at least a few years, so you notice the repeated sorts of things. And if you want to realize that eclipses are cyclical, you need records on the order of dozens or hundreds of years. The so-called Saros cycle is 18 years long. If you're trying to calculate out the recurrence of these sorts of things, there's certain numbers that appear in those calculations, at least the way that folks in the West did it. And I'm trying to remember what the number is. I think it's number 238 appears in these calculations for reoccurrence of solar eclipses. So, and at Stonehenge, there are all these little ditches in the ground that have since been filled in, but you can tell that they're there. And so if you count them, somebody counted them and said, oh, there's 238 or whatever this number is. I can't remember off the top of my head. Somebody said, well, if that number is present, then it must have something to do with the recurrence of solar eclipses. But it turns out that it's actually really unclear whether it's 238 or 237 or 240. So you can have a good argument about these sorts of things.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. So I think that the first thing, an idea that comes to mind is that we can be fairly certain, although again, I don't know, that ancient people would not have thought of the moon and the sun passing in front of the sun necessarily. Like it looks like they are merging.
Yeah. So a lot of the stories that appear around the world are of a consumption variety, mm-hmm. right? one body mm-hmm. is eating the other.
Yeah.
And since it's the sun that's vanishing, it's often that the moon is eating the sun or whatever entities are represented by them. Mm-hmm. Also very often conflict metaphors, they're battling in the sky mm-hmm. and then the sun triumphs and comes back after that.
Wow.
So I don't know if consumption metaphors sound right to you, Gabby. I mean,
they definitely fit the vibe, but I don't think they necessarily help us fully, like, get to understanding there. So I think we figured out the periodicity, I think, as human beings with our record-keeping mm-hmm. abilities. Maybe we've advanced past caveman, and we have some writing ability so we can clock periodicity, but we're still thinking of things in terms of dragons eating the sun or, you know, what have you. So how do we get from, in my head, that, you know, we know this thing happens regularly. We know mm-hmm. this is exactly what happens every single time that this thing is going to occur, to these are two things in space where one is in front of the other. Because that seems like the next big leap.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually a pretty tricky thing to, that's a tricky leap to do, because you can't prove it and you can't sort of demonstrate it. What you can show with your careful record keeping is that the sun is in the same place as the moon in the sky whenever this happens, because of your careful lunar record keeping, you know where the moon is on the sky. So even when you, a moment before the eclipse happens, you can run through your calculations and say, oh, the moon is just to the side of where the sun is going to be. And then they happen to be in the same place at the same time. But then you have to decide for yourself, what is the interesting thing that happens when they are in the same place in the sky? So it might be that they fight a battle. It might be that they try to eat each other. It might be that they just block each other out if they're just physical bodies in this way. So I think you need to have some conception of, say, the moon as a solid body and the sun as a light source that can be blocked in kind of the conventional way. And I don't know. I mean, to some sense, you have to decide what analogies are persuasive to you for explaining stuff in the physical world.
Yeah. Or even seeing them as three-dimensional is tough. Go ahead, Katie.
Yeah, no, because I was going to bring this up because I feel like we actually talked about this briefly on an episode a very long time ago about like the early thoughts about like what stars were, that it was more like the sky was like a dark dome and there were holes in it and that's where like the light came through or something like that. I hope I'm not completely pulling that out from betwixt my butt cheeks. But that's, it's hard when you look at the moon to, it's very easy to just be like, oh, this is a two-dimensional flat thing. To go in the conception of this is another place besides like in mythology.
Yeah, that's right.
I think plenty.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a place like the Earth that obeys the same kind of principles and rules, at least in some general sense. And that's, you know, that's one way to think about the things you see in the sky, but it's not the only way. I mean, we often call that, in philosophy of science, we call that a naturalistic interpretation of things. So instead of saying that the celestial bodies are gods or divine, they're natural in some way. They obey the general rules of physical reality. But then you can, even saying the moon is a dragon eating the sun, that's still naturalistic, right? A dragon's just a really big puppy or something, right? So then you need to kind of go one step beyond that to some kind of mechanistic view in which you say we should interpret the behaviors of the heavens not as living things, but as mechanical, physical, inert things that just work by moving and blocking each other out. And I think, I mean, I would make the case that that's a cultural assumption or option, right? That's a reasonable way to think about the universe for some kinds of people and not a reasonable way of thinking about the universe for other sorts of people.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if you know the answer to this, Matt, but like I have always wondered whether there were closet atheists in ancient society, you know, that they'd go to the temple and, you know, they'd see all this and they'd hear the stories about the great dragon or whatever, but that quietly to themselves, they're like, I don't think that's true.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they weren't always especially closet either. Oh. You know, Democritus, who we often name as the founder of the atomic theory, you know, some 3,000 years ago, was explicit that said, you know, the universe is just a bunch of atoms smashing into each other and we don't need gods for anything.
Oh, wow.
And then people like the Stoics say they didn't deny the existence of the gods. They just said it didn't matter, right? And you should, if the gods exist, they don't influence your life in any way. So just live for now. So there were plenty of those, actually. The idea that atheism was a heavily policed idea comes much later in Western history.
That's interesting. Because I was thinking about just, you know, all the great creation myths and stuff like that, and just imagining that there were other stories, but they were the more boring stories, so they didn't get passed down. You know, it's like, it's just a ball in space. Yeah, well, we're not going to talk about that at the campfire. We need to provide
a better show. For us, yeah.
Exactly. So, Gabby, how are you going to go about testing? Let's say, what is the myth that your tribe, or you know, what is the theory that your tribe has, and how are you going to test it?
Are we going back to caveman, or are we up to the point where we have writing
in your caveman? Well, yeah, your caveman society. How are they going to figure out? The if was what if the caveman tried to figure out what was going on.
So if I am a caveman, I am assuming I have some cave painting records from somebody else where somebody drew this big dark circle with like some weird light around it.
Yeah.
And maybe I can tell going back through the cave, this has happened a few other times. So maybe when it happens this time, I'm like not too freaking out because, you know, the world didn't end the last two times. So this time Throg and tribe will survive. But maybe I'm trying to think, cause this is like, so this is very different from my field of experimentation. But maybe then there's a layer of like context that gets added each time. Right. So everybody draws big circle, you know, big dark circle with a light around it. Right. Maybe somebody else draws stuff about, you know, the animals go quiet, drawing something about representations of other things that are happening at the same time. I think there is some thought that Neolithic, like Paleolithic people could, they did have some sort of day tracking. There was an article that came out about like marks that they make that they thought were like an early calendar, or something along those lines, some way to actually like track time. So maybe, you know, I'm part of the tribe that has figured that out. And in addition to my big circle drawing, I'm going to put when it happened. And leave that for the next generation of Throg and company. And if I'm very, very expeditious, maybe I go about talking to other people who are in the area. Because, you know, tribes were not particularly isolationist. Yep. They did talk and exchange, you know, materials and also people. And so maybe I talk to a group that's like 50 miles west of where we are. And they're like, oh, we didn't have that. And then, you know, Throg figure out that the eclipse only was happening, you know, in a certain area. So that not everywhere on that same date did the sun go dark.
Yep. That's that's a pretty huge step. And in fact, the ancient Greek astronomers did do that. And then even got more sophisticated because along with date keeping, then there's timekeeping too. So at a certain point, you can ask your neighbors, what time did the eclipse happen? And even if it's, you know, plus or minus an hour, that's a really important piece of information. And that's actually some of the information that they use to figure out that the Earth is round, is that eclipses happen at different times in different places. And they say, well, that only makes sense if there's a curve to the Earth. Yeah, all right. So if we've got, we figure out that it's localized. We figure out that the world doesn't end every time it happens, so that it's cyclic. And it seems to be, and it matches up with the motions of the celestial bodies in that way. And you can kind of imagine how this might snowball a little bit, where you say, oh, well, if it's cyclic, if the moon moves in these regular cycles, then that sounds more like a mechanical thing and less like a living thing. Mm-hmm. And if it's mechanical, then it's probably like that wheel that Throg invented last week. so maybe it's passive like that and not alive like a badger. And then if it's passive, then maybe it's just blocking out the light. So, you know, these ideas kind of build on each other and they start to make sense in concert with each other. But very hard to prove still at the end of the day. And the test that often gets put forward here is, can you predict the next eclipse based on your assumptions? And if you can do that, that's pretty impressive.
Right? Yeah, totally, totally. The other thing is, I think if it was mechanical, you know, if you start thinking of it as more a mechanical movement, then you might have some hope of not panicking. Or, you know, there would still have to be a degree of faith in, you know, in you. But like, as it begins, you might say, okay, it's just going to keep moving. The sun is going to come back, right? The sun disappearing must just be the weirdest thing. And then it stays dark for a number of minutes. And so those few minutes must have been the longest minutes in Throg's life, you know, because you would have no reason to expect that the sun was going to come back. Yeah.
I find this so funny though, because you had the much nicer way of interpreting this of this can help keep you calm if you know what's happening. I had the other way of if you know what's happening and nobody else doesn't, you're gonna seem like a wizard. Because now the sky will go dark and you know, you lift a hand and then everything goes black and everybody's gonna think you are like some kind of minor deity. And I think
many times
throughout history, I'm pretty sure eclipses coincided with like people taking them as omens and then like actual consequential things happened as a result of them changing their behavior after seeing what they perceived as an omen.
Yeah, well, as the story goes, Columbus recounts a story of using the prediction of a lunar eclipse to kind of get authority over the locals in exactly that way. You know, she says, you know, if you need to submit to me, or I'll make in this case it's a lunar eclipse. I'll make the moon turn red, and then it does. And he says, okay, I've decided to be merciful. I'll stop shortly. And then it did, and you're like, oh, that's great. And then
example 700,032 of how Columbus played dirty.
Yeah, exactly, right? And then Mark Twain uses that same trope in Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, that his protagonist uses the prediction of a solar eclipse to become king.
Awesome. I would have increased the defense budget by massive amounts and handed out a zillion bows and many, many arrows and defended the sun's honor. You know, so that when the moon started to attack the sun, we would have fired all our arrows at the moon. And this wouldn't work for year after year after year until eventually that turned into our space program. And that's how we got to the moon.
Well, I think that
was unnecessary.
I think that actually is, so again, when I said, you know, it's a dragon eating the moon, that actually comes from ancient China. That was, you know, part of the mythology, that it was like the celestial dragon that would eat the moon. And they would play, you know, bang drums and shoot arrows to try to scare off and like attack the dragon. So when you're like, you know, I'd assemble all my bows and arrows, congratulations, you have recreated another of humanity's eclipse mythologies. Because also think too, right? Mm-hmm. The eclipse only lasts about 4 minutes max. So if you're just like banging the hell out of some drums, eventually you're going to think it worked because the sun is back. So
And that's exactly right. So that's a pretty good, you know, you're pretty justified in that you took a particular action based on a particular hypothesis and you got the results you wanted. You might say that's a good reason for thinking your hypothesis is correct. So that's right. So there are a lot of practices involving battle, defending the sun. And then along the lines of what we were talking about with the silence before, is many of those rituals are also sound oriented, right? Banging drums and pans and things like that too. So maybe there's something there of trying to counteract the weird silence of the eclipse.
This is great. So Gabby, how does the story wind up? You know, at some point your descendants, there's Throg University now, and the Throg Empire stretches across a vast portion of the globe, and you have scientists everywhere. How do they just wrap up their committee and say, yep, we figured it out. It's two objects.
Eventually, with enough continued study, assumably Throg and company's descendants get to where we are today, where they are, you know, packing picnics to go and watch the solar eclipse. But perhaps shorter term, you know, maybe only a couple hundred years down the line, you know, the descendants of Throg and company are very, very good at making, like, I don't know, leaf pinhole cameras so they can watch the eclipse without completely blasting out their eyeballs. I think that's my legacy.
Yeah, that's interesting. It leads to an event of a great business in photography, making cameras, like, you know, Canon and Nikon, and then Throg. It began with pinhole cameras. They evolved. Matt, how do you imagine Throgs? Let's say you're a professor at Throg University, Throg Polytechnic.
Mm-hmm. Do I have tenure?
Yeah. I think so.
Okay. Oh, well, then I can talk about whatever I want, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. I'll go for this. Testing the theory beyond my predictions is going to get tricky. So I think I'm probably going to try to refine my predictions so I can get more and more precise. So, you know, for Greek astronomy, if you could predict the day a solar eclipse would happen, that was pretty good. Nowadays, we predict it down to the second. And I think that's one of the things that should impress you, right? And one reason to believe what astronomers have to say about why eclipses happen is that they can predict it so precisely and so reliably. So I think I would try to get down that route. And to do that, I need some professional observers. And if I can build a mechanical calculator, that would be pretty cool too. So if somebody could get on that.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Well, your students are right on it.
Yeah, my grad students, yeah.
Yeah, grad students are on it. That's fantastic. Wonderful. Well, it leads us up to a reminder that there is a solar eclipse coming. If you happen to be in the somewhere on the east side of the United States, from Texas up through Cleveland, through Buffalo, I believe then up to Burlington, Vermont. Interestingly enough, the cloud cover, this may change because the cloud, you know, the weather reports change very rapidly day by day. But at the moment, oddly enough, Texas, which is usually the best guarantee of clear skies, currently is forecast to have clouds.
Oh, is that right? I hadn't seen that.
And New York State, where we will be, Matt and I, has better than normal. Usually it's about 60% cloud cover in Buffalo, Rochester area. Mm-hmm. But we're looking at better, maybe 40% or even less chance of, like 30% chance of clouds. So it's better than nothing.
That's pretty cool. Nice.
And it looks like possibly, Gabby, were you saying you were going up to Vermont or that area?
We're going to last area minute is looking assess. To be, keep going.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, we're going to last minute assess based on weather forecasts where we go.
That's very good. Yeah. But it's looking like it'll be clear up in Vermont.
Yes.
Which is amazing. So,
Team Vermont. Yeah,
top teacher. Let's wait and see. Clearly, having a jet never plane been, like in the car. Never been to Vermont?
I've literally never been to Vermont. And so I find it tremendously amusing that I'm driving cumulatively about 12 hours to get to Vermont, to look up at the sky for 3 minutes and 32 seconds, and then go home. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Well, Vermont is a very beautiful place, so that'll be lovely. Most lovely during the fall, of course, but certainly lovely during spring, so that'll be nice. Matt, you, I just have a quick plug. You are speaking at the Rochester Museum of Science.
That's right. Both Saturday and Sunday this weekend, I'll be talking there. And then I'll be there to actually watch the eclipse on Monday afternoon. So if you're in the neighborhood, come say hi.
Oh, I see. So you're not speaking on Monday.
That's correct. I don't think there's any events on Monday other than the eclipse itself. So.
And what time are you speaking on Sunday?
Let me see.
I'll look that up. I will try to make that.
Not sure that's all stuff you've heard before. You don't need to go.
Oh, yeah. I love hearing it again. Editors are like that. We like watching the same thing over and over.
Well, that's true. That's a particular kind of psychological damage you've got there. Let's see here. Oh, so on Saturday, I am speaking at 9 p.m. At the Galactic Get Down, which is a somewhat more informal and zany event.
Fantastic.
And then on Sunday, I'll be speaking at 3:45, so 3:45 in the afternoon.
Excellent.
At a somewhat longer and more civilized event.
Oh, I'm sorry. Which time on Sunday? I'll look it up.
Sunday is 3:45.
3:45. Oh, okay. By the way, listeners, if you want to see a wonderful documentary that Matt Stanley is in that I made about Einstein that heavily features eclipses. In fact, one of my favorite sections is my editor and I created this beautiful section kind of in the middle of the documentary of all these different people telling the story of their first eclipse.
Oh, yeah, like, that is a great part. I'd forgotten about that.
Mm-hmm. And so if you go to YouTube and you just search for Einstein History Channel, it begins with Einstein smoking a pipe. You found the right one. And then you'll see Matt not smoking a pipe, but telling great stories.
Yes, that's right. Whether I'm smoking something else is another question.
Gabby, is there anything you would like to plug? You have like scientific findings you'll be releasing soon, I think.
Yeah. I mean, so for one, my paper is actually a preprint already on BioArchive. If you ever feel like torturing yourself with some dense scientific writing, so I'm co-first author on it. It is a genome-wide CRISPR-Cas9 arrayed screen reveals PLSCR1 as an inhibitor of SARS-CoV-2. Something along those lines. It's super dry of a title, but in case you're interested in SARS-2 entry factors and what I've been up to, you can go ahead and give that a read. If you are interested in something a little bit juicier, my latest short story is coming out in the anthology, The Map of Lost Places. It releases sometime in November, but I think they are doing pre-orders for it / some sort of assorted Kickstarter stuff. I'm very excited, so that'll be cool. I have other stuff that's still in the pipeline, but I'm not under contract yet. But more science fiction horror coming generally soonish from yours truly.
That's fantastic. Nice. Yeah, if you have a link for that, send it to me, and I'll put it in for the upcoming thing. And the listeners, if you don't know, if you haven't looked at, maybe you don't look at your app while you're playing the podcast, I do have links in there for Gabby's books as well, stories that are out now. So check those out as well. Thank you. And so, Matt, can you help people understand our closing ceremonies and the need for great courage?
Well, it's the restoring of reality to its previous state. So in this case, our leader of our tribe, Gabby, has told us that if we do not please her and bring her offerings, she will destroy the sun. And we have just done so. We have brought her all of our finest goods and horns and chipped stones. And finally, she says, okay, I will relent. I will bring the sun back again. But actually, it's cloudy, so the sun doesn't come back. So we throw our hands up and say,
what the
is? Thank you, Gabby. Good luck with wrapping up your PhD. Matt, good luck with continuing to use your PhD in good health, as my grandfather would say. And thank you all. Thank you, Patreon supporters, especially. Patreon supporters only are going to be getting our special bonus extended episode called Beyond the If. And that's just if you're on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/whattheif and find out more about that. Keep those cards and letters coming in. Lars, thank you. Cheers to you in Sweden and everyone else who's listening around the world. We'll see you next week. If the sun comes back.
It's an open question.